Hey, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Feature. And we have a fabulous guest whose movie is insane. You guys really got to see it. Oops, You're a Vampire. The director, maybe writer, I didn't check. Phil Messer's here. Messer, sorry. Welcome.
Hey, what's up, man? Yeah, I'm the writer, director, producer, shooter, editor, everything.
Awesome. I got to start at the beginning. This is one strange thing at times. I love it. So do you get that comment a lot from people going, what is this I'm watching?
I made the film. I still sometimes don't know what it is myself. I remember when I was making it, we didn't know what the hell we were doing. Every time we shot, we'd see we were shooting like a different movie because it's such a roller coaster of emotions and a time. It goes from like melodrama to really dark comedy to thriller horror to so a little bit of everything. But that's life, you know. Life has a little bit of everything. So I think a good movie shouldn't just be kind of like one note. You know what I mean? It should be multidimensional. And the movie definitely is that.
I want to get into something I found notice. You have actors that don't look like actors, I guess I'm trying to say. Like, I really think I'm in some weird fantasy of myself. How did you find these people?
You mean you can't see them acting? Is that what you're saying?
No, which is fabulous. I really think these are real people.
That's what makes a good actor, really. I mean, you can't see the seams, you know, in anything. If you can see the sausage being made, you know, that's when it falls apart. And we have something called suspension of disbelief that we need to get across. So it's very important for us to lull you into a sense of, you know, people aren't doing what they're doing. They're just being. But yeah, these actors are fantastic.
Oh, yeah. I love them. I think you got a very distinct look of your film. Mm-hmm. And I think these people fit in their world perfectly.
We were very, very lucky. And I mean, this film took about 3 years to shoot. On and off. Yeah, I mean, this is like the ultimate micro-budget film, and I approached it like I was doing a series of short films, basically. And it was my first film, so I was learning what the hell I was doing. I mean, from the beginning to the end, it's a world of difference. So the fact that these actors stuck around, and they aged, you know, during the course of the production. I mean, two of them are playing 16-year-olds. They started out when they were like 20, ended up when they were like 23, but they still look pretty young. The mother is my favorite actress. She was actually only 29 at the time, and she plays like a old lady in her mid-50s. She's like lame and old and really depressed and morose and melancholy, and her, like, her son, the actor who plays her son, was actually 32. He was actually older than her, so she was nothing like that person, you know.
I'm shocked.
Yeah,
older than she is. I don't believe you, but obviously I have to.
You have to see her in real life. She was like she was the bubbliest little thing, and then, you know, she would come to set and then she would disappear inside a room for like half an hour, or she'd get makeup on. And, you know, we had an amazing makeup artist who would spend 2 hours on her and then 3 hours on the vampire girl. So, you know, and she would turn her into this old lady just with, you know, no plastics, nothing, just regular makeup. And she would come out after half an hour and she would emerge as this old lady. She was completely unrecognizable. She left an impression on me in her audition. And I said, do you have kids of your own? And she said, no, but I have a mother. Yeah. You know, so she had a, you know, she modeled herself after her own mother, I think, in a lot of ways. And she's a Bulgarian immigrant, which is a lot of directors worry about working with people with an accent. To me, that really made her stand out more and gave a lot of gravitas to that character.
I think
so, like one of the rules on set was never to correct her pronunciation of anything, because she got a lot of things wrong, and I thought that was part of the charm of that character. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would say that works for your storyline. As you get into it more, it makes sense.
It's an American Gothic. The whole movie is, you know, it's timeless. You don't know when it's taking place. it's you're kind of in a strange, surreal kind of world with these people. A movie that it kind of reminds me of was there was a movie with Nicole Kidman called The Others.
Yep, I've seen it.
Yeah, so it kind of in that vein where, you know, they're in a little bubble by themselves. I'm an immigrant myself. I came to this country when I was 7. And one thing I know is, you know, when you come to a different country, you're alone with your immediate family. There's no cousins. There's no huge network of resources of family to support you. And so you really feel very much alone and very much isolated in your little world. And so that brings you closer in a sense, but it also makes the whole world seem very distant. So, yeah, I really kind of wanted to get that across, that this little family, this little unit that's kind of alone and by themselves and isolated, and this, what happens to them, kind of makes that 100,000 times worse. So
I want to go back to something you said. You said it took 3 years to film this.
Yeah.
How does that work? Like, I mean, actors, did you have a full script, or were you still writing a script, or the location? Mm-hmm. Like, I have so many questions about 3 years of filming one thing.
Yeah, I had a location. Like, I didn't know what I was doing, to tell you the truth. And I had planned to film, like, 3/4 of the film in the first 2 weeks when we had the location. After about 4 or 5 days, I had, like, one scene in the can. And that's when I realized what kind of a filmmaker I was, that I was kind of this Kubrickian perfectionist, you know, that I was going to take my time and get this right. And after those 2 weeks, and I only had, like, I don't know, maybe 8 minutes of the film finished, I came up to them and I said, look, I'm learning as I go. If you really like the script, if you really like, and what we were getting was pretty cool. Those 8 minutes were rocked, you know? But I said, look, we're going to shoot this on weekends or whenever we can get out here. And if you want to stick around, if you want to keep doing it. And that was at that point their decision to make, and they decided to stay and do it. It's the fact that it was such a small cast really helped me out, and they were really dedicated. And during those 3 years, I mean, they really did become a family when you say you couldn't see their acting. I mean, yeah, we had a lot of rehearsals, and in those rehearsals, a lot of the time I would just let them sit and jabber. And one of the girls came up to me and said, we don't do very much rehearsing. I said, well, you know, this is rehearsing. You guys just doing your thing, just becoming a family. I trust you as actors to come and be there on set and to bring it. You know, I cast you because I have faith in you. And yeah, I mean, they brought it.
Yeah, I want to go back to one of your first shots. A pile of bones in the macabre memorial. That looked beautiful. What is that really?
Which one? What?
Right at the beginning, you have like a big pile of bones, and I'm going through maybe a tomb of some kind. I mean, the lighting isn't the greatest, and I'm not sure if it's a mural, but I love it. What is that?
There's a series of artworks called The Tiny Tragedies. Her name is Coral Amour, and you can actually order them. And they're little art pieces, little boxes, and she makes little vignettes, little sets, and little scenes. That are really gothic and kind of Tim Burton-esque. And I saw one that kind of mimicked our storyline with the blonde and the brunette. And I bought it, and I asked her if I could put it in the film. I added all the little skulls and stuff. So I made it a little more intricate. But, yeah, that was just a little artwork. And I made it look like it was the character who had created it. So
absolutely.
She has this little altar to Anne Rice, and she's very goth, and she's like a little 16-year-old Anne Rice, so, you know.
Okay, the house location, I mean, they use the house the most, and you're saying you had this location for 3 years?
The house belonged to this old couple who who at first were a little hesitant, and then we were about to shoot, and they decided against it, and I had to beg them to let us shoot there for the first 2 weeks. And then, you know, once we got there, we showed that we weren't going to make a mess, and I gave them some money, and I fixed up the house a little bit. Like, if you see there's a shot in the roof, the roof's all messed up. I gave them money to fix up the roof. So we came there, I mean, a maximum of, I don't know, 6 times to shoot. I'm just saying it wasn't 3 years consistently. It was 3 years. every once in a while we would go there. Quiet, please. I'm doing an interview. Sorry.
It happens. Don't worry. Keep going.
So yeah, and that was the house. It was a very cool little house, very like American Gothic. The basement is actually, that house has no basement. If you know anything about architecture, the basement was shot somewhere else. It was actually shot in this townhouse in Brooklyn where I lived at the time. And there was a fire in the building, and the landlord was getting some insurance money to redo the place. And I asked him if I could destroy the basement before he was going to remodel it. And he said, fine, go ahead, you have a week. So in a week, I shot all that stuff in the basement, and I covered the place with blood. And it was a funny story because they went and fixed it up, but they hired some lazy dudes, and all they did was paint over the blood. And then some girl moved into the place, and she was supposedly like a nice little Christian girl. And one day in the hot summer, the blood, you know, it's made out of Karo syrup. It started to bleed through the walls. And she freaked out, thought that the walls were bleeding, and ran out of the house screaming. So that was one of the stories with the locations. But yeah, it was very, very minimal locations. At the time, I was very nervous about not having control. So everything was extremely controlled. This whole film was very kind of constrained, and it was my first attempt, so I had to make sure I had everything down right. And like my second film is called Underbelly Blues. It's very different. It's a lot of improv. It was like 15 locations, 13-day shoot, 40 different actors. It was almost exact opposite of this. Yeah. This was like very controlled little microcosm where I knew I controlled everything. And that was just like, let chaos reign and I'll try and curb it in. So yeah, I mean, it was me experimenting and seeing what I could do. If you see like the first scenes that I shot of that film, compared to like 3 years later, I mean, it's such a world of difference.
I'm going to back you up just for 1 second. I know you're going to keep going. Mm-hmm. Is the first scenes or the first ones I shot that's a little more wonky, I would say, on the camera angles, like when they first meet the family, like we haven't really got into it yet. Because it seems at the end you're much more focused on your shooting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And the very first scene I shot was probably the toughest scene, which was the birthday party.
Yes.
Which had like 30 school kids from the local high school drama club. I just went to the high school. I asked the drama club if they wanted their kids to be in it. And it was a cold night, and I only had them for like an hour. And everybody was stressed out, and it was just me trying to figure out what the hell I was doing. So, yeah. And I had, you know, before the shoot, I had meticulously had shot lists and storyboards and stuff like that. Towards the end, I threw all that away and just kind of like went with my gut. If you're not going to the set and looking around and saying, okay, this is what I got, this is what I can do, this is what I can work with, then you're not really going to inspire confidence, and you're not really going to get what you could possibly get. If you're really that concerned and that worried and that by the book, you're not really a director. Director's in the moment. Anybody can just play by color, you know, color by number type thing. But a director is really in the moment, and on set is when your directing abilities really are called for. So
okay, yeah. Costuming. You have no money for costumes. I mean, I know that. You think, how did you get your costumes then? Because they all have a distinct look. Everybody has a distinct look. Yeah, goes up. Every character has one. They don't seem the same.
I'm very big on, you know, thrift stores and flea markets and garage sales. I'm huge in garage sales. Can I show you my apartment? Just so you see what I do. I collect stuff all day long. Every Saturday I'm at a garage sale. So I find, yeah, let's turn the light off for a second.
Okay, people, you're going to have to, I know you're listening to this on audio, but you'll have to check out the video when it's posted because it's pretty cool. Lots of stuff, people. Statues, Egyptian statues, bottles. It's just tons of stuff. You guys just got to watch the video. I'm sorry. It's not going to work on audio too much here.
It's been a mess. And this is a bunch of guns that I'm creating for a science fiction film that I have planned called Sick World. And this is my wife. Her name is Little Demon.
Hello.
And that's our puppies. Where's the other one?
It was in the bedroom.
Oh, you ran into the bedroom. Okay. I'm going back to my interview. Hello, Bandit. Bandit's come to join us.
So you're constantly thinking of your next project is what I'm hearing.
Of course, yeah.
Well, how difficult is that? I mean, you spent 3 years on your first project. I don't know how long you spent your second project. I haven't seen it. So while you're filming over 3 years, did you ever think, I'm not going to finish this?
Sure. It gets stressful, and it becomes kind of an obsession, and it becomes like something hanging over your head, you know, that you have to get done. Plus, life gets in the way. You need to make a living, you know? All of these things are passion projects. Nobody's making any money. And, you know, how much time do you really have to work on your passion projects? This is something that anybody can relate to. Everybody likes to do things, to have hobbies and whatnot. Some people's hobbies just a little more ambitious than others, I guess. So, yeah, I mean, this is something I try and stay involved in the filmmaking community. I live in LA now, and here we have incredible resources in terms of actors. Oh my God, you can't throw a rock without hitting fucking some brilliant actor.
True. Yeah.
And they're all willing to work for free pretty much just for the exposure. I mean, to this day, I don't think I've ever paid an actor. that's the deal. You know, all my money that I have from my movies, which is very little, goes to, you know, the very basic necessities. Just to feed the actors or just to transport them or whatever. I mean, I've gotten pretty good at stretching a dollar these days in my time, you know.
Okay. I found the film look grainy at times. Did you do a color correction on that, or is that just the film stock used?
I tried to go for like a film look, like a Mario Bava kind of old, saturated, you know, something that didn't look too video-y.
No, it definitely did not look video-y at all to me.
Yeah, so I wanted it to look kind of like romantic and filmic and almost dreamlike in a sense. So, yeah, I'm very conscious of the look. I shot the whole thing myself. And, like, if you saw the original footage, the raw footage, a lot of people who saw it thought that I had corrupted it, that it was just garbage because I had saturated the reds. I had white balanced it completely off white, so that everything you saw in the raw footage was just had this giant, just red tint to everything. It just looked terrible. But I had enough experience in post-production to know what happens if I take certain colors out. So when I took all the red out, all that remained was the blood, and everybody else like was white, and everything else was blue, and so a lot of that saturation was just perfect. Because red, you can't take red out once you shoot it in there. But once you take everything else out, red from everything else, the red that is there stands out that much more. So, yeah, stuff like that. I really had some fun with it.
Okay, you have a quite diverse collection of mugs. From all your garage sale shopping?
I still do, yeah. We still have a lot of mugs. Most of them are my wife's now. She loves to collect mugs. I collect all kinds of crap, you know. But, I'm a collector.
Okay. I made a note, apple pie. Who doesn't like apple pie?
Well, apple pie is American, you know. I wanted to make an American reference there. So this is an American moment there where a nuclear family is broken up, and anybody can relate to that. I still want to make my – this was not the great suburban film that I want to make one day, which kind of like tells the American story, the loss of identity, the homogenization of American culture, the strip malls from sea to shiny sea, which I think is kind of a really scary thing where, we were losing our sense of ourselves, and all we are is just something carbon copied and convenient. And that convenience is taking away our soul. And so, I mean, that's something that really wasn't expressed here, but in some ways it was a little bit. But this is a suburban story about a suburban family, and but they don't belong in suburbia, really. I mean, it's an immigrant family, and the kids might be American, but culturally they're kind of an anomaly.
The Snake Man. Where did you find him?
I think for some reason my assistant director at the time just pulled out a headshot and said he had some headshots just collected, and I saw this guy's face and I said, oh my god, this guy, he's going to be my Vincent Price, you know. Oh, yeah. And so I called him up, and I'm still very good friends with him. He's like the biggest fan of this film, champion of it. He loves it so much. And I'm currently kind of writing a part two. I've been tentative about it, but I don't think it's going to be about the family, but it'll be kind of like a thematic vampire trilogy, because I have created my own kind of vampire mythology, and it really begs to be explained a lot more than I do in this film. And there's so much more to it, really, that I haven't, that I only just touch on the surface in there. But, if anything, he'll probably return to explain some more of it. As you see in the end there, he had some kind of, he had some more mysterious connection to the whole story than we realized. So
how did you sign your music? You have music I've never heard in my life.
Really?
Genres of music. I had so much fun enjoying it.
Yeah. I take my music very seriously. I come from an editing background. So, you know, music brings your video to life, you know. Without music, it just feels, it's, music lulls you into that sense of, disbelief. The suspension of disbelief, really helped out by music. And so as an editor, one thing I do is I edit to music. Which most filmmakers, they'll get a composer to score after it's been edited. If you look at my film, I use classical music a lot, like Rossini's Barber of Seville in the first dinner scene. And it looks like the Barber of Seville was put onto that scene, because all the nuances, all the little cues are working visually because I made it happen like that, you know? So, classical music, I'm a big fan of. There's a lot of like goth bands that I've found around. And then there's a lot of like free music from incompetech.com, because really, one thing about this film and my other films is that it's really a DIY, and I hope to inspire people to do it themselves, because there's really no excuses anymore. There's no more middlemen. Nobody needs to greenlight you. No. You just roll up your sleeves, you get a small camera, everything is HD now, you get involved with some actors, and you know it's daunting, incredibly daunting. But once you get on that road, once you're on it, you'll find a lot of little miracles happening and a lot of things falling into place. I don't know. I think God helps those who help themselves, or who reach for the stars and bite off more than they can chew. So yeah, I mean, I'm completely unaffiliated with any studio, any real production company. It's just me and doing my thing. So anybody can do what I do. So I try and I just shot a little film. It's called American Hitman. The entire thing I shot on my iPhone with one actor.
Wow.
And I called it two guys in a phone production, because really that's all it was. And it's like a mockumentary about a hitman who finds out he's got cancer and decides to tell all, and take the documentary guy on around as he kills people. So it's a pretty cool little film, and with an amazing actor named Chris Anthem, who died recently or right after I finished shooting.
Ouch.
The lady who played the mom in this film also died. She had died of a brain cancer.
Oh.
So yeah, I'm very happy that I was able to give them both a chance to, show off their craft. But yeah, it's all very sad. We won't be seeing them again.
Okay, drawing of the Spanish army. Where did that come from?
No, that was created. I commissioned an artist. I'll tell you the whole story. I was living in Brooklyn, and I had some vague notions of a dream of becoming a filmmaker one day. It wasn't really realistic. I loved films. I was an editor, but I had these kids move upstairs, and they were college kids going to art school. One of them was a filmmaking student, and one of them was an artist. He did etchings, so an illustrator. And so the filmmaker was the one who inspired me. His name was Justin Letty, to make the film at all, because he made a little short film that I helped out with. And as I'm watching it, I'm like, I could do this. You know, this is just doable. It's just this on a bigger scale. You know, just take whatever savings I have and toss it in there. What am I saving it for? Buying a house, whatever. You know, this is what I want to do. So he inspired me to do it just by showing me. Somebody needs to show you that it can be done. You know, let me get close the door. Hold on.
Mama, I'm trying to do this. Come on.
So, yeah, and the other guy was an artist, and I commissioned him to create these amazing illustrations. And it took him a while to do this. Like I said, it took the film 3 years to be completed. Those 3 years he spent making those. So, yeah, among other things he was making. But, yeah, after about 3 years, it was all completed as well.
Okay, this may be a weird statement, but I'm going to say it. The Jesus of Latter-day Saint guy spills cake on himself. Maybe that's so hard. Is there a second take, or is that just a one take? You know exactly the scene I'm talking about.
Yeah, that wasn't scripted, no. No, but just I had to grab it. Yeah. And the whole Mormon thing, this is a Stephanie Meyer thing. You know, she's a Mormon. I don't know if you know the writer of Twilight.
I know who she is.
And, Twilight is a very Mormon text. People don't realize it. You know, the number one theme is abstinence. You know, they don't have sex in this movie because, like, if the vampire gets aroused, he's liable to kill her. You know what I mean? So he has to restrain himself, and abstinence is everything. This is a teenage romance, Mormon style. So, yeah, and the whole sparkling vampires thing. I mean, I wanted to make an anti-Twilight in so many ways about teenagers who are, and the real vampires, what real horror vampirism would be. Because to me, there's really very little romance in it whatsoever in killing people for sustenance.
In my notes, because you have some great discussion on religion. Mm-hmm. Latter-day Saint. I love it. Now, I do. Do you have an issue with religion, or do you embrace it and discuss it?
Well, I think I already mentioned that, you know, miracles happen, and I believe in God. I'm very devout. I very much believe in God. I have issues with religion, sure. Religion and you know, people and dogma and people passing judgment on others. And, yeah, there's all kinds of questions. Spiritual, you know, theological questions that I try and delve into in all my films. It's just something that I think about a lot, and something that, you know. So, you know, this is a character who's very much, he's a 16-year-old precocious little brat who thinks she knows everything. And she's questioned it herself, and she, you know, finds that there's some issues with religion, and she brings it up and kind of like, you know, gives the Mormons a hard time. So, yeah.
Okay. Making of the head. How did you do that? Like, there's got to be more than one head, I'm thinking.
More than one?
Head. One fake head.
No, there was one fake head. That's always
just one?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was hard enough to make that one, trust me.
How did you make it?
Because we had to make the skin underneath, because your face gets pulled off. And I had to make the face on top of it. That was a complicated, sophisticated thing. And that was our makeup artist. We didn't do too many really complex, sophisticated special effects. That was probably the most complicated one. So we had some fun with that, yeah.
Okay. Christmas dinner meal. Mm-hmm. Is the food real? The corn look real to me, but you're not close enough for me to give you an actual, yeah, I think it's real. I couldn't tell because you're having so much fun in that scene. I'm not really focusing on the food.
It's a lot cheaper to make real food than it is to get fake food.
That's fine, man.
It's all real food. And as a matter of fact, like at the end of that shoot, that was the last thing we shot in the basement. And like I said, we had a week to shoot everything in the basement. And that whole week, I was just, I didn't sleep a wink. So I was going full on. And at the end of that week, when I called rap, everybody left, and I didn't come back to that basement for another week. When I came back, all that food was still on the table, and it was rotting. It was a stench in the air. And I was just like, I had to. I just couldn't do it. I just had to get out and go sleep. And so, yeah, that was that was the story with the food. The other scene in the Thanksgiving scene in the beginning, we had that big turkey. That was also. There's a shot in the beginning where the very first shot is we're in the middle of the table. And we pan 360 degrees around the room. So I'm in the middle, and there's a turkey and food in front of us. You know, it's a very, very hard shot to get, but I really wanted to get it. This is what I'm saying when I'm saying I can't shoot a scene in a whole movie in a week because it takes me 5 hours to make that shot, you know?
Yes, I can believe that.
So, you know, I had to, like, that wasn't an actual table. That was just food placed on little stools and stuff around me to be in the foreground. And I had to, like, you know, revolve the camera that way and walk around it and stuff. It was a very, very hard shot to get.
Okay, before I let you go, I have three fun questions for you.
Sure.
Favorite film, because first time on the show.
All-time favorite film or favorite horror film or
whatever you would like to bring up.
All-time favorite film is The Big Lebowski.
Oh, great film. No issues.
I'm a writer, and I've actually wrote a sequel to The Big Lebowski. That's how much I love it. And it was like an exercise for me, and I was like, if I can do justice to Walter and the dude, then I can write anything. So if you want to check it out, I think you could go on lillebowski.com. I think lillebowski.com. You can actually read my sequel that I wrote, which is pretty fun. I actually handed it to Ethan Cohen once. Never heard back.
One person you'll work with in the future when you decide to actually pay people.
I'm a huge, huge fan of Danny McBride.
No issues.
Love yeah, that. And I actually have an idea for a film with him, which is kind of like Ghostbusters meets Evil Dead. Ooh. Which I think he would just be perfect
for it. Sounds good.
And, yeah, so look forward to that, hopefully, in the future. But that's the one actor in my mind right now that I really want to work with.
Okay, one film you always recommend to people that they never watch.
That I never watch? That they haven't seen, or
I always recommend Gun Crazy, which is one of my favorite films, but nobody ever goes to watch
the original it. Gun Crazy.
That's the one. I love that film, but nobody watches it. I recommend it all the time. Nobody ever.
I'm a huge film noir fan. I love old movies. You know, I studied the hell out of them. But if I was gonna say recommend something that somebody really needs to watch. In general, Korean cinema of the 21st century.
Been amazing.
And in particular, start off with a film called I Saw the Devil Kim Ji-woo. The three great directors, Kim Ji-woo, Bong Joon-ho, and Park Chan-wook is the...
Yep, I agree with you. No complaints from this guy.
Usually people ask me what my favorite vampire film is, and I usually say Thirst by Park Chan-wook. But also Old Boy and Vengeance Trilogy by Park Chan-wook. So, if I really, and people haven't seen it, American audiences are just catching on. But in the last, and they're all my age too, all these guys. And they didn't even have a cinema or a music industry prior to the 21st century. I spent a lot of time in Seoul. I'm an editor, so I've cut like K-pop documentaries, and they fly me out there to edit stuff. So I had a real good chance to immerse myself in that culture, which is absolutely embryonic. And so stuff like K-pop, I mean, you're talking about a music industry. It's the only music industry that's grown exponentially while our music industry flounders because you know, the entire business model is just up in the air. No, you know, the days of selling units of product are over.
Correct. But
the days of getting a billion hits on your YouTube video in the first, you know, month of its, you know, those days are upon us. So yeah, these are the days of, you know, grassroots filmmaking, grassroots art, where we have the ability to connect with our own audience, and we just have to figure out how to do it. It's all about, you know, and horror is one of the best in that sense, because it's such a niche audience that really supports indie films. Like, all of the horror classics are all, you know, they're all made for a shoestring budget. You talk about, you know, Halloween to Evil Dead, you know, Night of the Living Dead, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street. Those are all made for pennies, you know. So horror audiences are probably the most receptive to, you know, low budgets. Other than that, comedy, I think, is you know, comedy doesn't cost a dime. And the only real currency is laughs. If you can make people laugh, then you can compete with Hollywood. You know what I mean? Because Hollywood's having a hard time making people laugh these days. The same comedians that have been doing it for 30 years, you know, they're stuck in that mold where they don't give anybody new a chance. So,
okay, before I have to let you go, where can everybody find your film?
It's on Tubi, and it's on Freevee. It's on Prime. So it's absolutely free. Go check it out. Oops, You're a Vampire. It's a very cool little flick. It's a, you know, labor of love. And people seem to like it.
Thank you for your time, and have a great evening.
Thank you so much, Simon. God bless, and I wish you all the best in your endeavors.
Hey, thanks for listening to that interview with Simon. Can you please rate and review us on iTunes and Spotify? And if you have any extra change, feel free to send it to us at PayPal. And that's extrafeatures@gmail.com on PayPal. Thank you. Bye.